Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning. You are listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Steve Goldstein. I'm Lauren Gilger. Thank you for joining us. And a special hello to listeners on KAWC in Yuma, now carrying the show. Hello to all of you on Colorado River Public Media in Yuma and in Parker. Coming up today on the show, fewer high schoolers in Arizona are going on to college. We'll talk about what that means for the future of the state. And Maricopa County has one of the highest rates of new infections of HIV in the country. We'll talk about that.
But first, eight people have applied to the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors to be named the new county attorney, at least through the 2020 election. Each candidate intends to run for the office in next year's election. And Rachel Mitchell, now best known for her part in the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings last year, plans to run for the job even if she isn't appointed to the position. So who's in the running and who seems most likely to succeed Maricopa County attorney turned state Supreme Court Justice Bill Montgomery? Joining us now to tell us more is Jim Small, editor of the Arizona Mirror. Jim, good morning.
Good morning.
So let's talk about some of the bigger names on the list. Any surprises there at all in terms of the interest level? Were there other names you expected to see that you didn't?
No, I mean, these were names. Most of the names that are on here are names that we'd heard that were interested before, some of whom had popped up in media reports, others who once it became clear, you know, in the immediate aftermath of Bill Montgomery being appointed to the Arizona Supreme Court, people started really throwing their hats in the ring. You know, there were obviously some names I think that were on here that we didn't know if they were going to apply. But for the most part, I think everyone who we expected to apply for the post did.
Any standouts to you, Jim? And as you look at this list, who do you think is a top contender?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Rachel Mitchell has the job right now as the interim county attorney. So I think that she obviously is in the mix. You know, I've heard a lot of people have certainly within Republican circles have been bullish on Lacey Cooper, who is at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Phoenix. And obviously there was a lot of speculation and discussion about Rodney Glassman throwing his hat into the ring on this. Rodney Glassman is ran for the Corporation Commission a couple years ago and lost. And before that, he was he's a Republican now. But before that, he was a Democrat. He was on the Tucson City Council as a Democrat, ran for the state, the chairmanship of the state Democratic Party a couple times a number of years ago. And so, you know, he's someone who, you know, within the political world, people are trying to figure out kind of what he's up to. And it looks, you know, I think to a lot of people, like this is someone who's out there angling, casting about for a role and for a job, for an elected position.
Jim, this is bound to get pretty intense as we go along once the choice is made, because we certainly expect to see a number of Democrats going for this open position. How much do you think, based on the political knowledge you have and knowledge of this community, how big a difference do you think it's going to make based on who is chosen for this? Rachel Mitchell certainly has a higher profile now, but has never been in the political realm. And we heard that was something that kind of stunned Bill Montgomery the first time he actually ran for the office. It was like, wow, this is actually a political office in addition to managing things. How do you think that might play into not necessarily who gets chosen, but the next step they're able to take?
Well, it is. And certainly, you know, you've got a couple of people on here who have run political campaigns, Rodney Glassman being one, Krista Rose, who had been appointed clerk of the court a couple of years ago for a brief period. He's run political campaigns. John Cadis, who's a prominent lobbyist and lawyer, used to be a state legislator and at one time ran for attorney general. And these are people who at least have some experience in the political world, not all of it successful, and certainly not in recent times having any successes. But you're right, though. I mean, this is a job that is inherently political. You have to, in order to keep the job, you have to run for office. You have to go on the campaign trail. And a lot of the decisions you make, you know, are going to be scrutinized, I think, through that lens of politics. And so it is definitely a thing to be concerned about. I mean, obviously, everyone who's on here says that they're going to run for the office again. And in terms of how the appointment could potentially put this race in play for Democrats in 2020. You know, my guess is if the status quo is maintained, Republicans are going to come into that race with a pretty heavy advantage. I think the opening for Democrats is if someone gets appointed to that job and comes out of the Republican field who seems to be unqualified for it. And, you know, looking at the resumes of the folks who've applied for it, there doesn't really seem to be anybody who directly smacks of someone who is totally incapable and unqualified for being county attorney.
Okay. That is Jim Small, editor of the Arizona Mirror. Jim, always good to catch up. Thanks.
Thanks.
A goal for 60% of Arizona high school graduates to obtain post-high school education or training appears unattainable. That's because fewer high schoolers are going on to college or vocational training than previous generations of Arizonans. An in-depth story by Arizona Republic higher education reporter Rachel Leingang explores why Arizona is struggling to create a more educated workforce, and she joins us now to talk more about it. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's start with some of the blockbuster stats here. There were some things in here that really surprised me. What did you find?
Like you had mentioned, the idea that older generations are more educated than younger ones, for folks who are 65 and over, we rank in the top 20, which is good. But for people who are 25 to 34, we rank 40th in the nation. So that's a huge difference for how we're doing there. One stat I think is super shocking is that at this rate, only 70% of ninth graders right now will be graduating with bachelor's degrees by 2028, and that's a super small portion. So
17%, yeah.
Yeah, there's just a lot of things like that where, you know, even as someone who covers this, when I saw those stats, I was like, whoa, worse than I thought. Yeah. What are we going to do about it, basically?
Right. I want to get to that in a second, but let's first talk quickly about what's led to this. You looked at preparedness, you looked at finance, the money that goes into this. What are the big factors?
So for on an individual level and on a societal level, the big factors here are basically like money across the system. Individually, it's super hard to pay for college. But as a system, you know, our systems here are underfunded compared to other states. And then our high schools really aren't necessarily preparing a student for what comes next. Some are doing a really good job at that, and a lot of them are not.
Rachel, the people you spoke to, considering there's been this renewed commitment to try to do something about it from really almost all over the spectrum, this has to be stunning, doesn't it? The idea that we were already playing catch-up and now we're playing catch-up in an even deeper way than we thought before?
I think there's just been more understanding of what it looks like. Having that goal, I think, has a lot of people thinking more deeply about this. So it's not necessarily that these problems didn't exist or even that they're getting worse. It's just that now we know what they look like. And really, that's a huge part of it. Like, setting the goal, bringing all the people to the table, helped people get a better understanding of the depth of what we need to do.
Okay, so let's talk then about implications here. I mean, you talk about the effect on the future economy of the state, about having a workforce that we need to continue to grow the way that we are right now. What are the big findings here?
I think there's really no one who wouldn't be affected by this. Like, if you live here, if you have kids in school, of course. But I mean, do you pay taxes? Do you drive on roads? Do you live in a neighborhood? There's really no one who wouldn't see some sort of downstream or direct effect from something like this. So if you run a business and you can't find workers, can you run your business? Do you move to a state, you know, like Colorado, which is much more educated, nearby? You know, what would stop you from moving to that place instead of staying here?
So what are some proposed solutions, short and long term?
You know, there's all sorts of ideas, none of which have really gathered a lot of steam here. So things that have worked in other states, on the money front, you know, the FAFSA, which is a key to getting kids to college, we have one of the worst rates for filling that out. In Louisiana, they require kids to fill it out before they graduate from high school, and it's, you know, monumentally changed how many people are filling it out. To me, that just means you have kids who understand their financial options. I think that's a big factor, because a lot of people don't fill it out just thinking, I don't have money. But if you don't know, you don't know. You know, we don't have, like, a statewide financial aid program. Many states are doing this. I know New Mexico is considering right now a free tuition program. We haven't really discussed that in any sort of serious way. So there are definitely ideas kind of floating around, but nothing that's really, I mean, even seriously being discussed at this point.
All right. That is Rachel Leingang, education reporter with the Arizona Republic. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
So far, there are 3 confirmed cases of vaping-related respiratory illness in Maricopa County as medical professionals brace for more. Nationwide, 7 people have died, and the Center for Disease Control reports more than 380 cases of vaping-related hospitalizations in 37 states. For people who vape or use e-cigarettes, symptoms include shortness of breath, chest pain, and a level of coughing that is reminiscent of bronchitis. With me to talk more about this is emergency room physician Dr. Nicholas Vasquez. Dr. Vasquez, were you and other medical professionals anticipating something like this might emerge in people who vape?
You know, I think the severity of the lung illness is definitely a surprise to us, but I think most physicians were expecting some negative health consequences from vaping to arise. It's been some time that vaping has been around. We've noticed a significant increase in the amount of teenagers vaping flavored products. We've noticed, as an aside, I personally have treated people who have accidentally vaped fentanyl-laced cartridges. Some people have died from that. And then the other thing we definitely observed and wondered about was an ad campaign essentially promoting vaping products as an alternative to smoking and a way to quit. We were anticipating negative health consequences, but the severity has surprised us.
Dr. Vasquez, what do you make of the fact that the CDC is reporting the majority of the cases the agency has learned about involve vaping devices used for marijuana? And what do you make of the kinds of cases we're hearing about now related to vaping?
The vaping illness that we've seen that's been reported lately is more prevalent than I think we know. My guess would be that what we are seeing are the worst cases, the ones that are the most identifiable. But anybody with a respiratory illness who vapes, who feels short of breath or has difficulty breathing, but not to the point where they need to be hospitalized, may also have that same vaping illness, just not to the same severity. What we're hoping is that these kind of moments highlight that igniting anything and then smoking it can potentially be dangerous for your health.
How do you as a physician figure out what's going on? If someone's a juvenile, are you going to say in front of their parents, hey, are you vaping? Are you having those kinds of conversations, or do certain physicians have to?
I and my brethren will ask those questions in front of the parents, but sometimes if I get a sense or if I want to be certain about it, I'll ask the parents to step out and then I'll ask the child, 14 or above or 12 or above, if they're vaping at all.
There are some who have made the argument that those who are addicted to cigarettes, that in some cases, e-cigarettes, that vaping helps them gradually perhaps wane and move away from this sort of addiction?
So first and foremost, you have to understand, I am an ex-smoker. I picked up the habit in late medical school, early residency, which is just almost unforgivable, and I had to quit. And I will tell you, the best and only way to quit is to deal with the emotions that you are medicating daily with the products that you've got. The other thing is that nicotine is addictive. And so whether it comes in the form of a cigarette or whether it comes in the form of vaping, it's still addictive. And it will still induce behaviors to go seek out those, whatever vehicle you're using to deliver it. The only way you can get over nicotine is 2 weeks of abstinence with nicotine, where you feel pretty miserable. But after that 2 weeks, you're kind of free. After that, it's just the relationship that you have with the source that you were getting your nicotine from, whether it be cigarettes or vaping. You still have this 2 years or so in your life where you're vulnerable to going back to the relationship where when you were stressed, you had a friend, or when you were upset, you had a friend. When you had someone that you could turn to that wouldn't tell you no, called cigarettes or vaping. The other thing to think about is nicotine is so addictive that is classified actually as more addictive than cocaine. And for a young brain, for a teenage brain specifically, there's just almost no way in which someone has the personal willpower to overcome that addiction. I tell my patients that quitting smoking by cutting down is like breaking up with someone, but still going out with them. You really do need to go cold turkey. Otherwise, you're still exposed to nicotine. It will still induce the habit. You will still know it's there. There's just no other way other than letting go. I know it's difficult. I've walked that walk.
Considering what you said about we're seeing some of the most extreme cases, is this sort of just the beginning? Do you think as more people learn about the potential connection to vaping, and perhaps maybe that's why they're having these issues, do you expect to see more people in emergency rooms seeing their doctors, and then we're going to get a lot more reported cases here and across the country?
I do. I think that despite the alarms people are going to want to see for themselves. And if they do so, expose themselves, and then just sheer numbers mean our cases are going to go up. And it's something where I think the emergency departments are going to have an increase in awareness of looking at, is this vaping related or is this not? You know, as the numbers go up, we will definitely be much more aware of it. But each year the flu comes around, so we're not sure, is it the flu, is it allergies, is it bronchitis, is it valley fever? We have lots of suspects. So I think we're going to see a lot more cases, and I hope we're able to identify them and tell the public about them.
That is Valley Emergency Room physician Dr. Nicholas Vasquez.
Last week, a man and a woman were arrested for living inside a Chandler home that was vacant and up for sale. When police arrived, the Arizona Republic reports that Adriana Gamboa was found giving her child a bath upstairs in the master bathroom. Another child was running around still wet. At first, the 26-year-old mother told police she was a potential buyer, but later she said she was trying to find peace and quiet from a domestic violence shelter where she had been staying. She was booked for trespassing and possession of drug paraphernalia, the Republic reports. Her children were taken from her and put into the state's child welfare system. This has left some wondering if there could have been another way. Should circumstances be considered for victims of domestic violence? For more on that, I sat down with Alicia Durfee, an expert in domestic violence and a professor at ASU. And I asked her, was charging this woman and taking her kids the right answer in this case, in her opinion?
I don't think it was. I think historically we've had a heavy criminal justice response focused on arrests to when people are engaging in offending. And we know that that's not an effective deterrent. Right. And in fact, arrest often produces the opposite effect. So you have this woman who is already marginalized and now she's going to have a record, right, which is going to make it harder for her to get a job, harder for her to secure housing. So if the idea is to get her kind of in a stable situation and with her and her children, then I think this is producing actually the opposite effect.
Does being a victim of domestic violence, she said she was in a shelter for domestic violence before this happened, does that play a role in the way that the law enforcement officers or the criminal justice system in general will approach her?
I think it should. So we know that the number one cause of homelessness for women and children in the United States actually is domestic violence. So you have a lot of women and children fleeing domestic violence. And because we don't have a lot of the economic support programs that we used to have in the United States, they have no resources to rely on. They have nowhere to go. Now, with the increase in criminalization in the 1980s, and especially the idea that we are going to combat domestic violence with arrest and criminal justice responses, the effect of that was to defund a lot of domestic violence service programs. Mm. So I don't know of any shelter in the Valley, and the Valley shelters here are fantastic and fabulous and play an important role, but I don't know that any of them would say we have sufficient programming to provide all the programming we need to all the people who need it.
I want to get into that more in a moment, but first I want to talk about the decision to put her children also in the foster care system, take her children away from her. Is that common in terms of domestic violence situations? Like, is it a deterrent, I wonder, for victims of domestic violence to calling law enforcement in the first place?
I think it is. So what you see is individuals who have survived an act of violence don't have a lot of options open to them. Now, one of them that we push them towards is calling the police. But when you bring the police into your home, you become entangled in the system in so many ways. So all of a sudden, you're dealing with CPS. And even though you may have called the police to protect your children, they're going to start questioning you on whether your children is your priority, right? And you also become enmeshed in all kinds of other systems. So let's say your immigration status isn't clear, or God forbid the people you live with, their immigration status isn't clear. Or perhaps you're suffering from drug or alcohol addiction, right? Which is a very common way that survivors cope. So they become entangled in all these different systems when all they were trying to do is reach out and get help and say that I am not safe.
How might things be different elsewhere? Like, are there parts of the country, parts of the state that are addressing these issues differently?
There are a number of courts that are approaching it differently. Now, I conduct research with the Mesa Municipal Court. Last July, what they did is they started doing a community court. And what it does is it takes people who are engaging in chronic low-level offending, that is due more to the circumstances that they're in and social problems. So thinking about homelessness, thinking about drug and alcohol addiction, and connecting them to services rather than doing criminal prosecution. And while we have these kind of, they're usually like a deferred prosecution, or maybe they plead guilty and, you know, then they don't serve any sentence, but they still have a criminal record then. What MACE is doing that's different than, say, some of the other courts is that the prosecutor, if the person completes a program, completely dismisses those charges. So Adrienne Gamboa was going to have an arrest charge, and she's, you know, if they choose to prosecute it, is going to have to disclose this to employers. But if she was going through a court like MESA, actually that would all disappear.
So what about law enforcement's role in this? Like, how can they be better prepared, I guess, or educated or trained to address situations like this?
I think we often think of, like, training. Like, this is the act of individual people rather than thinking that this is an institutionalized response. So I don't know how much latitude the officers had when they got out there in making an arrest or not. If that's the departmental policy, then they have to arrest. It's like what we see with mandatory arrest programs for domestic violence. Officers may not think arrest is the best solution, but they're bound by the state statutes and departmental policies. Mm-hmm. I know officers, and they are very compassionate, but they are limited in their roles. I think we need to think structurally, institutionally, as to what options are we providing to them. What are we saying is the automatic reaction, right, which is arrest and prosecution. And people don't have latitude necessarily to make those decisions. So institutionally, how do we give more options in cases where the context should be considered rather than just the crime that was committed?
So in your view, would that be sort of expanding this community court model that MESA is using right now?
So the Center for Court Innovation has really done a lot of research on community courts, and they're showing it's very effective in dealing with these types of offenses. And I think people are starting to think more strategically about how do we respond. Like, if we don't want people to offend again, in this case with Adriana, is arresting her and taking away her children going to mean that she's not going to offend again? If we want to ensure that she doesn't offend again, we need to connect her to services, we need to connect her to housing, we need to connect her to possibly childcare. Those are the kinds of things that are going to help her not end up in the same situation again, rather than thinking, well, if we just punish her harshly, then next time when she's in this horrible situation, she will not make these choices because of such a harsh response.
All right. Alicia Durfee is a professor at ASU in the School of Social Transformation. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
The question of who is an American should be relatively easy to define because it's different than asking who's an American citizen. Clashes over immigration policy, though, have made the conversation much more dramatic and uncomfortable, especially over the past couple of years. Journalist Jose Antonio Vargas has experienced all of it on the most personal level since he, as an undocumented preteen, came from the Philippines to live with his grandparents in Mountain View, California. Vargas generated headlines when he came out publicly in the New York Times Magazine as an undocumented immigrant earlier this decade. Since then, Vargas has founded the media and culture organization Define American. And tonight in the Valley, he'll be giving the Flynn Foundation Centennial Lecture presented by ASU's Barrett the Honors College. I spoke with him earlier via Skype and started by asking about the Trump administration's policies on immigration and how he believes that has affected the overall perception of immigrants in the U.S.
I think in general, we have an actual information crisis in this country when it comes to this issue. Most people, when they hear immigration, a lot of kind of images flash in their heads. And a lot of that is because we have married the issue of immigration with one group of people, specifically Latinx people, specifically Mexicans. For me, as someone who's Filipino, as someone who's, you know, from a category perspective, I'm considered like Asian Pacific Islander. To me, the language we use on this issue has actually been very limiting in the way we talk about this issue. It is so accepted in people's psyche that undocumented people, what President Trump calls illegals or illegal aliens, right? It has been so cemented in people's psyche that undocumented immigrants don't contribute anything to the economy, that even the mainstream news media, even they don't report on the fact that undocumented workers contribute billions of dollars in Social Security and pay billions of dollars in taxes. Mm-hmm. Immigration is not one size fits all. So even the language we use overall in the issue have actually been a barrier to understanding what it is we're actually talking about.
When someone is undocumented and all the things that encompasses, you're in a different nation, which has become your home, but then there are a number of people who question whether this should be your home or not. So what does that mean to be able to, I'll steal your phrase, to define American? Can you define yourself as an American, even as others are trying to define you as not an American?
When I think of defining American, for me personally, I think for me, it's meant, how does my community, how has it defined me? And by nature, how have I been defined by them? Let me give you an example. Like last month, my community of Mountain View, California, where I grew up, I did not expect that my community would name an elementary school after me. Like, there's no process for me to legalize myself and, you know, get through a path to citizenship, but there's a process for a local school district where I grew up to name an elementary school after me. Can they do this? Is this legal? And then I started thinking, well, yeah, you can say that, you know, I am here illegally without authorization from the government. You can say all of that, but what you cannot say is that I'm not from Mountain View. I mean, the Mountain View Public Library is why I am as well-read as I am, and that's why I know who Stephen Sondheim is, right? The Mountain View Public Library is where I borrowed, like, you know, different CDs, understanding what makes Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet different from Prokofiev.
Do we as individuals have to take responsibility, or do we in groups need to take responsibility from this standpoint? There are a lot of people who I think would say that they're lucky to have been born in America, but when people are either critical or fearful or whatever of immigrants, undocumented, otherwise, whatever it may be, whether they've lived in this country most of their lives or not, is the feeling that the borders are supposed to mean more than the actual human connection or the actual human opportunity is.
I think all of us, especially at a time like this, I mean, I don't even really know what the historical parallel is for what we're living through.
Yeah.
I mean, it feels like we're living through a civil war and a reconstruction all at once, and we don't have a shared collective. People who watch Fox News have a very different set of reality than people who watch MSNBC. So to me, what's at stake here is our idea of what America is. You know, like all around the country now, as I will do when I go to Tempe, you know, I ask people, are you a US citizen? And they say, yes. Well, what'd you do? How'd you get it? Oh, I was born here. So wait, the accident of birth? Is that it? Is that what made the country so great? Like, we forget that America is work. We have to actually work at America, at what we think the ideal aspirational America is. And I would argue that the immigrant in America who has made that courageous choice to come here, and we forget that, I think, in the bastardizing of the language around this issue is also the bastardizing of the idea that it's courageous for people to come here. Right? Like, most people don't leave what they know, the language, the culture, all. They don't leave what they know and risk everything to come and go somewhere else. That's an act of courage. And I think we've lost that. And I think when people fight for an America, I don't think they understand or want to understand the fullness of America. Like, for example, we like to say that we're a nation of immigrants, right? I mean, we love saying that. I think in some ways, I would argue that we are just now in 2019, we are now just really grappling with the full force of our own history.
When you hear the term tribalism, is that offensive? Is that obnoxious? Does that make sense to you? A lot of people jump on that and say, well, one of the issues is that we're all trying to go into our little groups.
Well, but I think that's what a country has always done. I mean, if you read the history of the Irish and the Italians and the Germans, that's why we are obsessed with Italian history. That's why we're obsessed with mobster films, as if all Italians are parts of the mob. I think the history of this country has been the history of tribes, but the struggle to claim this thing called America and to be this thing called an American, what complicates it now is that in the past, that question has been, for the most part, defined by white people. I mean, I've always been really curious, like, when did people become white? When did that happen? Weren't they Irish and Germans and, you know, and Polish, Scottish and Norwegian before they got here? Apparently, I'm Asian. I did not know that until I got to America, because I thought I was Filipino. And what I think we are all trying to work towards, in my opinion, and I hope so, idea of what an American is. and that it's not tied to one country or one culture or to one language. Like, we all benefit when we all can see and hear and watch each other. Like, that has always been kind of our magic sauce. That's what makes us so unique.
Jose Antonio Vargas is the author of Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen, and he'll be speaking tonight in Tempe, giving the Flynn Foundation Centennial Lecture presented by ASU's Barrett, the Honors College.
Good morning. You're listening to the show here on KJZZ. I'm Lauren Gilger, along with Steve Goldstein. Stay tuned at 10 o'clock for The Takeaway. But first, when a lot of us think about HIV or AIDS, we might think it's a story about the past. We might think about Angels in America or some of the countless people we've lost to the epidemic in the 1980s. But when Dr. Ann Kalsa walks through the halls of the McDowell Healthcare Center in downtown Phoenix, she's sometimes overwhelmed by the number of people coming in who are newly infected with the virus. Hundreds of people of all stripes are still diagnosed every year at the clinic, which is part of the Maricopa Integrated Health System. In fact, Maricopa County is one of 48 counties in the country with the highest rates of new infections. But there are also efforts to combat this. In February, the U.S. Surgeon General visited Phoenix to highlight a national initiative aimed at reducing new infections by 75% in the next 5 years. I sat down with Dr. Kalsa recently at the clinic to talk more about the problem and the efforts to reduce it. And we were joined by her medical assistant, Robert Honor, who is himself HIV positive and went into this line of work because of that.
So HIV is still increasing nationally at about 35,000 new cases a year. Back in the 90s, it was like 55,000. And then we got down into the 40s and in the 30s, which is an improvement, but still, that's 30,000 way too many. Even here in Arizona, we've got over 700 new cases annually. And here at the county clinic, because patients often are young and healthy and they come in with no insurance, we get a couple hundred new patients a year. So we get a large percentage of that statewide total. And the reason we keep seeing new cases is the prevention message just isn't out there. People think, oh, it's not me, it's the older guys, HIV is not out there anymore. Or some of the young guys think, it's treatable, give me a shot of penicillin for syphilis, give me a pill for HIV, I'm fine, I still want to play and have fun. I don't need to do anything, it's treatable. And it is. No one needs to die of HIV/AIDS anymore, but it is a pill every day, and it's frequent doctor visits. You have a medical condition that you will be reminded of, and why not prevent it?
What kind of demographics are we looking at when we talk about new infections?
We have, the majority is still the less than 30. It is certainly disproportionate in the Black and Hispanic communities, and I think a lot of that is there's more stigma, it's more hidden, there's less prevention messages, and they're less aware of connection to healthcare and availability of prevention services. So, for example, there's a national standard that 1 in 2, 50% of all African-American gay men will become HIV positive. And something like 1 in 4 for Latino gay men versus 1 in 11 for white gay men.
Okay, so I want to pivot to you, Robert, and talk a little bit about your own story and why you work in this field now, why you work with Dr. Kalsa. When were you diagnosed?
Diagnosed probably about 15, 16 years ago in North Carolina. Back then, I thought the demographic was homosexuality, and just like the stigma. Everybody thought it was homosexuality that was the cause of the disease. Until I started working here at McDowell, the demographic is so broad. There's refugees to Hispanic, to African-American, to bisexual, straight, gay, transgender. It's all over the board. And I was shocked. And I love making a difference in my community and educating them in helping them get to the facilities and care that they need in referrals or outside facilities or within MIHS.
So when we're talking about young people getting this diagnosis now, I can imagine that you being somebody who's been living with this for 15 years might be a voice that would be really helpful for them to hear in that moment. Do you both sort of talk to patients in that way?
Absolutely. I think what it was with me, the only problem I had with it was coming up into rejection. Like when trying to meet somebody, the rejection part, telling them the truth, being truthful about your diagnosis, I think that's the hardest thing that young people have to deal with because they're still coming out of the closet or trying to find themselves and the rejection. Some of it's pride. They don't want to come to terms with it because of pride or their family members or their demographic. Their community doesn't accept it. I always tell patients that are struggling with it, it's about you. It's not about everybody else, what they think about you. It's about you, your care, how you perceive it, and your acceptance of yourself.
We really focus on reframing their living with the HIV infection in a positive way. So many people still think, oh my God, I'm HIV positive, I'm gonna develop AIDS and I'm gonna die. Because that's where the fear immediately kicks in. And again, that is no longer the reality. It often becomes a positive opportunity to reframe your lifestyle to be healthy, to have enough sleep and good nutrition and take your meds and be consistent in healthcare, where a lot of people prior to that, you know, you come out of your teens and 20s, you're young and healthy, you can do whatever you want and ignore it and you're still fine, your hangovers don't last long, et cetera, et cetera. And now they really have to come to terms with it, but it really can become a life transforming process of learning to live in a positive way. It's interesting, not only is Robert here working in the clinic, himself living with the disease and obviously perfectly healthy, we've got like half a dozen other staff members here at all levels who chose to go back into the medical field or to focus in HIV medicine after their own diagnosis. So it doesn't need to be a negative experience.
But there is still, I imagine, a stigma around this, like you said. What kinds of reactions do you usually get from people, especially young people who might be really surprised to find themselves in this situation?
Sometimes, like Robert mentioned, there's a lot of shame or stigma. And again, depending on their community, some come out and tell their families and some don't. Some get kicked out of home. I know we've been focusing a lot on the young people. We're still seeing patients coming in newly diagnosed greater than 50. So it's not just the youngsters, and some of them really struggle as well.
Do either of you ever see patients come in, get the diagnosis, and then refuse treatment or ignore treatment because of this kind of stigma?
Yes. Yes, and it's sad when we do see patients who fail to cope. We have one young man, unfortunately, who was infected from a traumatic event, and his immune system was fine several years ago. And he would only come into clinic once every year or so because it was too emotionally painful to deal with. And now he has unfortunately progressed to advanced disease and he still won't take treatment. He's now entering hospice and he's less than 30. He could not get past his own internal shame and the trauma of what he endured to become positive. We've had some of our African refugee immigrants who endured rape, et cetera, in the process of coming to this country, who when they first are diagnosed are horribly stigmatized and traumatized because in their cultures, many of them come from rather conservative religious backgrounds, Christian or Muslim, and being diagnosed HIV positive is not acceptable. And so I'll see them curl up in a ball and cry in the exam room. And we keep embracing them and reassuring them, and once they feel better, they suddenly realize, oh my God, you're right. I really can have a life. The other thing Robert was talking about, people being afraid of getting rejected with relationships. And so many of my people come in and think, oh my God, now I'm never going to have a relationship, a partner, a family. And we reassure them and reassure them there are negative patients who will understand that you will not transmit if you are undetectable. And we have quite a few people now in serodivergent, one positive person, one HIV negative person, in a long-term relationship, happily and fine.
On that note, when I first came a patient here at McDowell and I came over the rejection, I met my partner. My partner's negative, and I've been with him going on 16 years. It's not a death sentence, like Dr. Kalsa said. I try to iterate that to my patients. I see they're struggling with it, and I open up to them and let them know my status. They're like, really? They don't realize that because I don't look it. Be honest with yourself. That's all I can say. It's be honest about it, and you'll come to terms with it. Whoever is in your life still will accept you for who you are, not what you have.
So lastly, then, I want to talk about the efforts to reduce this, to reduce new infections. There's this national initiative. They're aiming to essentially reduce new infections by 75% in the next 5 years, and eventually, I think by 2030, have no new infections. That sounds like a lofty goal. Is it achievable?
It actually is achievable. It's part of a worldwide initiative called 90-90-90-0, which is to get 90% of people who are already infected tested and diagnosed. Because when we first started looking at this, 30% of people didn't know they had it, and so then they could progress, let alone spread it. So get 90% diagnosed, 90% on treatment and always taking meds, and 90% of those successfully suppressing their virus. And that actually will lead to 73% of the community having an undetectable viral load. If you then put the people who are at risk of being exposed on the prevention medicine, you can actually start to see declining rates in a community. And this has been shown in various cities around the world, including San Francisco, including South Africa. So it is successfully doable, but it requires all parts of your community taking up the call.
Dr. Ann Colsa, Robert Honor, thank you both for having me.
Thank you.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
So, yep, it does. I go by CPRO here at HeatSync Labs. My real name is Andrew Luton. We are a hackerspace. Also, other people might know it as a makerspace.
So is that good?
Yeah, that's good.
My name is Giles. I want to try to build a robot.
We like, getting everybody interested in technology, old technology, new technology, and anything in between.
What if music actually turns on?
Well, we can make our own music with this if we control it. So I think we should take this apart and actually find out what makes it tick, or in this case, what makes it oscillate. You can sit there and discuss theory all you want, but unless you tear apart something and actually see how it works, and see the components that make it up, you won't get the understanding of it.
That's Andrew Luton showing Giles Johnston how to tear apart technology at HeatSync Labs. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, send us a note at the show at kjzz.org.
Phoenix this week launched its six-month e-scooter pilot program in a part of downtown. Over that time, up to 300 of the scooters will be allowed in the area. At the end of 6 months, the city will decide to either extend the pilot, make it permanent, or let it end. Meanwhile, a new analysis of potential micromobility, like bike share and e-scooters, finds Phoenix in the top 25 of big American cities. The transportation data firm INRIX did the review, which looked at the number of car trips in a city and how long they were, breaking them down by 0 to 1 miles, 1 to 2 miles, and 2 to 3 miles. It then looked at what percentage of those trips could potentially be taken by micromobility devices in each city. Our co-host Mark Brody talked more about this with Trevor Reed, a transportation analyst with INRIX.
Were there any things in common that the top cities specifically in the U.S. had? I'm just looking at the top five of Honolulu, New Orleans, Nashville, Chicago, and Charlotte. On the surface, it doesn't necessarily seem like those cities all have a ton in common, but for this purpose, did you find some commonalities there?
Yeah, so Honolulu and New Orleans, a lot of those, they're fairly dense cities. Honolulu is restricted by the water. New Orleans is also restricted by the water in a lot of places, and it's an older city. And similarly, Chicago is an older city as well. And as population density increases, there's typically a higher number of short distance trips, just because it's easier. You know, if you're in a dense area, there's probably, you know, two or three grocery stores within a couple minutes. Whereas if you're in a real spread out area, you have to drive further. So denser cities, more short distance trips typically.
I guess it's not surprising that density would be a key factor here, and the fact that more people living in a downtown area where there's also shops, restaurants, grocery stores, things that they need to get to that aren't super far away.
Yeah, exactly. But even in more diffuse cities like Phoenix or down in Dallas-Fort Worth area, there's still a very high proportion of, you know, short distance trips. So it's not only the dense cities that have a large potential for micromobility, it's just that they have higher potential, I would say.
How are these various cities handling this issue? Because it's obviously been a contentious one in a lot of places, including here in Phoenix. So have you found any sort of common ways that cities are trying to roll these out or regulate these types of micromobility devices?
Yeah, so initially the micromobility providers, they kind of tried the Lyft Uber model where they dumped the scooters with little consultation with the cities and little regulation. You know, the idea being that they would build up a lot of popular support for them and then they would negotiate with cities. And that approach had varied success. Right now, there's been a lot more collaboration and there's a lot more regulation at the city level. And they're being both, you know, the providers and the cities are being a lot more conscientious as to how they implement micromobility.
When you look at the potential for scooters, bikes, that sort of thing, how important is that relationship between the companies that own the devices and the cities in which they're trying to rent them out to realizing that potential?
Oh, it's absolutely critical because, you know, the biggest impediment right now to wider adoption is the lack of safe facilities. So I know Phoenix is very car dependent and there's a lot of places where there's sidewalks, you know, they don't run between the blocks and there's, you know, a limited bike network or protected cycle network. And so if the cities aren't able to work with the providers to create that safe infrastructure, the likelihood of it really taking off at the entire city scale is very unlikely.
So let me ask you specifically about Phoenix, which was ranked 23rd out of 25 in your analysis. And you broke this down by trips of 0 to 1 mile, 1 to 2 miles, 2 to 3 miles. And what you found is that in that first category, that 0 to 1 mile, there's a 17% potential for Phoenix and an overall 43%, which was in the top 25 of American cities, which I think a lot of people would find kind of surprising, given, as we talked about earlier, the importance of density to these overall rankings.
Yeah, so we were looking at the large metro areas in the U.S., so typically, you know, more than 250,000, which filters out quite a few of those smaller cities. And Phoenix, it has in the top 25, it has, you know, less than average number of trips in that 0 to 1 mile range. And that's because it's not a very dense city. It's a sprawling city, but, you know, it's flat and there's little rain and there's, you know, certainly space to, you know, implement this infrastructure. So there's still massive potential for Phoenix to implement micromobility.
Are you finding that for these cities which have this kind of potential that cities and their maybe public works departments are looking into developing some kind of infrastructure? You mentioned bike infrastructure in a place like Phoenix. Are cities looking at specific other type of micromobility infrastructure in those cities to try to boost some of that potential also?
Yeah, and one of the real issues that has emerged is a lack of storage facilities. So I'm sure, you know, in the newspaper, you'll see photos of the scooters being left, you know, in trees and sidewalks and just kind of scattered all around. And what cities are really being aggressive now is creating designated parking areas. So taking one space of on-street parking, you know, you can store probably 20 to 30 scooters in that. And so if you were just to create dedicated facilities for storage throughout the city, it would really reduce a lot of conflict.
How excited are cities to have this kind of potential? Like, is this something that cities are wanting, or is it something they're kind of looking at warily to see maybe how it's going to all play out?
I think it's a really exciting opportunity because it's very low cost, very high coverage, and it's very affordable and accessible. So in Seattle, part of the condition for the bike share companies to operate is they have to spread bikes in lower income neighborhoods and throughout the city. And it's a very cost-effective way to reach populations that it's very difficult to provide public transit services for. And as micromobility is integrated to a higher degree, its benefits will only increase.
All right. That's Trevor Reed, a transportation analyst with INRIX. Trevor, thanks. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.